ultimately, when we see the explanations given in the different religions, our intelligence will tell us what is God and what is not God. A Hindu who thinks, when you bring him to the reality of what he worships, the main object of worship, Shiva, is represented by what is called in the Hindi language, lingam. Lingam is an erect penis. This is the main object of worship of Hindus. Now, a thinking Hindu, if he reflects, he can come to the conclusion that this can't be God. Seriously, you know. And what I'm telling you, this is not like a story made up by Muslims about Hindus, you know. You can go to any encyclopedia, go to Encyclopedia Britannica or any book even written by Hindus about their religion. And they will tell you, you just go look for Shiva and Lingam. If we go and look at the various objects of worship, you have people worshipping trees, some worshipping idols of stone, some worshipping animals, some worshipping human beings. And you ask each person, why are you worshipping this object? Why have you taken this as God? Person will tell you, when I pray to my God, my prayers are answered. We have to understand this. A person who worships a tree would not continue to worship that tree if his prayers were never answered. So believe, there are people worshipping trees whose prayers are answered. Now you have to reflect. Intelligence comes into play now. Is the tree answering that prayer? No. You can cut the tree down and the tree is not answering this man's prayer. The one who's worshipping the animal, the one who's worshipping the stone, same thing. It is not the animal answering the prayer. It's not the stone answering. Even the man, it is not the man answering the prayer. Because there is very little difference between a man, an animal, a tree, and a stone. The difference is fine. Spirit, which man has, which separates him, the choice between good and evil, which separates him out. But if you take that out, what you're left with is a physical being that is like an animal. And that physical being like an animal is like a vegetable in the vegetable world, which is very similar to stone. It's made up of elements which if you crumped it all together, you can make a lump of stone out of it. So none of these created beings answer man's prayers. Those prayers are answered by God alone. So it is only in the religion where God alone is worshipped that you will find the true path to God. So a person looks at what is presented by each and everyone, and where he finds that the teachings of this religion call him to the worship of God alone without any intermediaries, not in the form of his creation in any way, shape, or form, that is the religion of God. That was the religion of Moses, of Jesus, of Abraham, of Adam. Because any religion which is going to depend on you knowing an individual, in other words, for you to be saved, for you to attain salvation, you must, as a Christian, know Jesus. So what of all the people who never heard of Jesus? No chance for salvation. So depending on your knowledge of a particular... Well, who determines whether you know about Jesus or not? The destiny of God. So God destines that you be born in a place where you never hear of Jesus, and then he throws you into hell for not hearing of Jesus and believing in him. Logically, this is not justice, even in our limited sense. And God is the most just. So the religion of God must be universally attainable. From the teachings that were brought by the prophets, people can go back to that original teaching, which is the worship of the one true God alone. This is the starting point. And then, of course, you go on to look at other features. You know, to what degree does the religion support the worship of that God, of one God? Are the principles of the religion against human nature? Do they deal with the various aspects of a human being's life, or are they limited only to certain aspects? You know, because religion, the religion of God, should in essence be comprehensive. It shouldn't leave anything out. Man still has to decide, though everything is explained to him, he still has to decide, do it or don't do it. But he should have guidance in all aspects of his life. So, he looks at the various religions as they present themselves, looks for clarity, and what we believe, what Islam teaches, is that it is only in Islam that you will find that clarity of who God is, a system which encourages each and every one to worship God within all its principles, which takes into account human nature, it helps man in all spheres and aspects of his life. It is embodied in Islam. All of the other religions that you find on this earth, they involve worshipping God's creation in the name of God. They believe that they're worshipping God, but in fact, they are worshipping God's creation. This is something common to all. And it is only in Islam, in the final form, as well as was taught by Prophet Jesus and Prophet Moses, Prophet Abraham and Prophet Adam, that you find the correct teachings with regards to God. Are you asking me, do they get peace and satisfaction? I'm not saying if they get it, they can follow it. I mean, before God, they're still responsible. But if they did not find their prayers answered, some of their prayers answered, then they would not continue to worship it. This is what I'm saying. That as a test from God, people turn to God in prayer in all of the different forms. And everyone experiences some of their prayers answered and some of their prayers not answered. Because if it were known in the world that whenever a Muslim raises his hands in prayer, his prayers are answered. He wants a Mercedes, he puts his hand up, Mercedes comes. Do you think there would remain anyone on the earth who is not a Muslim? No. So the Muslim, like everybody else, he will raise his hand. Some prayers are answered, some prayers are not answered. So he's not judging the rightness or wrongness of religion based on whether his prayers are answered or not. Because God answers prayers according to his own wisdom. What is good for you may think something should be good for you and it's really harmful to you. That is with the knowledge of God. However, the Prophet did tell Muslims that the prayers of the believers are all answered. However, not all in this life. Because we may pray, as we said, for something which is not good for you. So God will not give you that thing. However, the reward for that prayer is given to you on the day of judgment. So your prayers will all be answered.
And you have to ensure that everything is not as somebody would. You can say that I am going to be somebody. Nobody cannot explain it. Nobody can say that I am a guilty person.
No one can say you are a guilty person. No, of course, they can. The law of God defines you as a murderer subject to be killed. Islamic law says if you kill somebody, you must be killed. Mosaic law says you kill, you will be killed. The fact that God knows that you are going to kill and allowed you to kill does not excuse you from the sin of killing. You are still responsible for your act. Knowledge, the fact that God knows what you're going to do doesn't make you do what you do. It is still you choosing to do. And because of that, you are responsible for your choice. Can you understand that?
So, whatever written, you mean to say that already written everything in our life. You mean to say that what is really not saying?
The destiny of God, based on his knowledge of all things, is a part of him being God. Once you say this is God, it means he knows all things. The rising of all things is an expression of his knowledge of all things. But it doesn't mean that he makes you do or makes you not do. So if you decide to pray, it is written that you prayed. If you decide not to pray, it is written that you decided not to pray. But it's still you deciding to pray or not to pray. And he has also prepared for you a reward when you pray. Okay?
We talked about various religions, believers, non-believers, and you elaborated greatly on intelligent people being able to decide between the truth, fact, weighing the differences. There are still many people who perhaps aren't educated, certainly in the United States, you have adults that aren't educated, cannot weigh facts like that because some of them can't even read. And then you have various countries where people may not even have a Quran or Bible or anything of that nature. Yet in some fashion or another, because of that innate instability or instilled spirit from the beginning of Adam, they know about God. So therefore you have Jews and Christians and Muslims and all kinds of religions. Now if Islam is the true religion, these people are believing whatever it is that they believe because that's all they know. Will they go to the hellfire or paradise?
Well,
can you elaborate on that?
The point is that each person is shown signs in their life. If they're following falsehood, God shows them signs in their life of the falsehood of what they're following. If they choose to realize what is false and seek the truth, then God continues to reveal to them truth until they attain the truth. It may be in the full form that they actually come in contact with Islam and they meet the full teachings, or it may be in a partial form that they reach a certain point but they die, and God knows what their intent was, what their beliefs were, and he rewards as he pleases. And for sure, we know God is just. But remember that Islam fundamentally means submission to the will of God, in the pure sense, the true God. So wherever a person does so, he is on the path of Islam. And God will judge him according to the knowledge that came to him, what was available to him. But in general, once he has gotten on that path, if he continues honestly to follow and to improve himself and to do righteousness and believe in a judgment that he is responsible for what he does in this life, etc., then basically he is on a path to paradise. But the final judgment is with God. And, you know, our brother just mentioned the verse in the Quran wherein Allah says that we will not punish a people until we have sent a messenger to them. That the punishment of God comes on those who found out the message came to them and they chose not to follow it. Then they are punished. Because God is just.
There are some quotations from the Bible on how the father,
Abraham,
and Abraham.
Sorry.
There are some quotations from the Bible on how the prophet is like Abraham, Moses, and Aaron, and Jesus Christ. Knows how they worship. And I say here from the Old Testament in Genesis 17 verse 3, and Abraham kneels on his face, so he kneels on his face on the ground. And also Moses and Aaron, he do the same. And Jesus Christ is the abundance, also he do the same. But essentially, why don't the churches adopt the method of prayer followed by the prophet from Abraham on Sarah?
Well, because the church, as we know it today, is of the making of men. The true followers of Christ are today called Muslims. The followers of Christ in his time were Muslims, and the teachings of Christ are maintained within the teachings of Islam. It is not just the bowing, the prostration in prayer, because the Pope does it too. The Pope, when he gets off the plane, when he's going on the plane, he makes the prostration. Yes. He's the only one doing it. Nobody else does it. You know? It's not just that. Jesus himself didn't eat pork. But the vast majority of Christendom eats pork. The women around Jesus, when you see the paintings of Mary and the others, they're all covered up. The vast majority of what is known as Christendom today, women are half naked. So it is practice after practice after practice. We find when we look into what is now known as Christianity, we find that it has deviated from the actual teachings and practice of Christ and his companions. And it has become a system of a business, really. It has become a business proposition. We know from the televangelists, you know, all the way down to the Pope. I mean, him and the system and the hierarchy and the jobs and the, you know, it turned into a kind of a business. And as such, it did not follow the way of Christ. It's a contradiction in terms. People, as Christians, in fact, are not followers of Christ, but worshippers of Christ. Well, when a woman is divorced here, normally she goes back to her family. You'll not hear of a woman living alone in her apartment with her children. This is very unusual. You know, what happens, she will go back to her family. Either she'll go back to her parents, or she will go back to one of her brothers or her uncle, one of her close male relatives. She'll go and stay with them. She'll continue her life there, you know, until such time as she's remarried. So the family structure here takes her back in. So she's not really out there on her own, you know, having been married for 20 years, not learning any profession to look after herself, etc. And all of a sudden she's divorced, she's on the job market. You know, this now necessitates the courts, for example, in the West, to chop off a certain amount of money from the man's earnings to give to her, to protect her rights, and to alimony, etc., because here there's no alimony. Because fundamentally, it is the job of the family to look after the members of the family. This is Islamic principle. Where the family is incapable, then the state steps in. When a woman marries a man, she does not become this man's relative, in the sense that she is now within his direct family. She is linked to him by contract. When the contract is broken, that relationship ends. So his responsibility with her ends at that point. However, the responsibility shifts back to her family. Okay, the children, if the children are very young, normally they go with the mother to complete their period of upbringing. When they're at an age of discernment, which they calculate about the age of 7, 8, where the child can choose between which parent he wants to go with, it's given the choice.
Is there a responsibility of
the father? The father is his. No, because that child is his physical relative. It is the product of his relationship, which is a part of him. So he has a direct responsibility for that child. So he is obliged to continue to maintain the child. If the child goes back into the family and the family says, well, we don't need the money because we're fine, we're covering it, well, then the man is absolved of that requirement, you know, if that is the case. However, it is his responsibility, and he will fulfill it as long as he is capable of fulfilling it. Well, what they do traditionally here, you know, is that daughters are usually given to the father. Sons are usually given to the mother. Because daughters, for a woman to get married, she has to have the consent of her guardian, the closest male relative. Except if that consent is refused due to illegal considerations. So if a woman, normally the consent of the father is given, or her eldest brother, you know, if there is no father, normally it goes back to the father. It is really for her own protection, that he has checked the person out and is assured that this person is a good person who will look after his daughter. But if he refuses because he feels that the guy doesn't have that much money, I don't like his family or whatever, these kind of considerations are not sufficient grounds to stop the woman from marrying the person if she chooses to. And she can then take it to the court, and the court will override the father and allow the marriage. But under normal circumstances, the male guardian should be there for the marriage of the female. So this is why daughters are generally speaking given to the father, and sons, because the woman is encouraged in various circumstances, if she has to travel abroad or anything like this, she should have with her a male guardian. So then her son provides that guardianship for her. So the sons are usually given to the mothers. But essentially it is a choice, you know, which way they want to go. Yeah, the multiple marriages is still a part of the marital system, because what you're going to find is that Islamic law from 1400 years ago to today has not changed. It's the same Islamic law. It has not modified itself. The fundamental laws have not modified themselves, you know, according to the whims and the changes of the society, because the principles which are divinely ordained we believe to be universal and unchangeable. However, the application of these principles, you may find some variation in terms of rulings. For example, in the past, you know, when tobacco first came into this region, it was viewed to be disliked. You know, it was not prohibited and attacked from all fronts. However, in recent times, when the medical profession in America, you know, has identified it as being a source of cancer, then the change is now what the ruling, the Islamic ruling is, because now they have knowledge that it produces cancer, which kills people. So the ruling has changed, and the scholars rule it here to be prohibited, prohibited substance. So rulings may vary in that sense based on knowledge, but the fundamental principles, like that, for example, of polygamy, of a man having more than one wife, this is something which is standard. However, I'll explain that for you. The concept of multiple marriages in Islam is not an open concept, in the sense that a man just, he feels like taking another woman, he takes her and, you know, he keeps her however he feels like. No. He is required to look after her in the same way that he looks after the first wife that he's married to. She is on equal status. He has to treat her justly in the same way. So you have actually two households that he has to maintain, or three, or four, maximum of four, right? That he has to maintain completely. The children are all identified as his own children. He has responsibilities for them, upbringing, everything. So this is why you find that though this is permissible for Muslims wherever you go, you don't find more than 10 to 15% in any given society, even here, where people have a lot of money, a lot of people have a lot of money, there's no more than 10 to 15% who actually practice polygamy, because it's a responsibility. It's not just, you know, a right, you know, which you can take pleasure from. No, of course it is a right there which pleasure may be taken from, because this is part of marriage. However, it comes along with it a series of responsibilities.
Generally, when they have to go shopping or things like that, he's going to go, if he has four wives, you know, he has a Suburban, he's going to put all four wives in Suburban or whatever, they go shopping. How do all the four of those wives feel about being together with this one man, but all four of them together? And I'm sure they don't associate that much, because they do be, you know, distinctly held in different households, their children together. When they come together, what's the general consensus of them?
You know,
I mean, do they hate the other one?
But there's no general, right? I mean, jealousy is natural on the part of the woman, in the sense that her man sharing her, you know, with, or she sharing her man with another woman, of course, there's a certain amount of jealousy, generally speaking, amongst women. But In a society where people have accepted it as a part of the law, of divine law, you find that the problems which may exist, normally if you think about it in the West, the problems which may exist between the wives is minimized. You find, for example, the colonel, who's the head of my department in Riyadh, he has three wives, but they all live in the same house. But it's a big house, you know, so each has, you know, their own space within the house, but they're all living together. The children interact, the wives interact. If you met them, you think they're all sisters. They're just, you know, naturally sisters. Because, but of course, if a woman, for example, prefers to live separately in a separate home, she doesn't want to have anything to do with this other woman, this is also her right. You know, and he has to allow that right on her part. The children come together, and they are encouraged to mix up so that they don't, you know, feel any kind of dislike, etc. But the women are not obliged to be together all the time. I mean, they should be civil with each other because there are circumstances where they have to do things together. But, so you may find the situation may differ. That what he may do, instead of taking all four wives shopping one time, he may take one day, another day, they take in turns, you know. Or, depending on that relationship, they may all go together. So it really varies from family to family. It's very difficult to say, this is the way it is, you know. Where people are not as familiar with it, it tends to be, you know, rougher. Where people, it is more accepted in the society, it tends to be lesser. If you go to Pakistan, where it is practiced on a lower scale, then the differences tend to be greater. In here, where it is practiced on a larger scale, more well-known, then you find that the friction between wives is much less. One thing I'd like to mention here in terms of women and marriage is that when a woman marries a man here, she doesn't take on his name. She keeps her own name, because name indicates genealogy. When you see a man by the name of Muhammad Abdullah, it means Muhammad the son of Abdullah. When you see a woman, her name is Fatima, for example, her name will be Fatima bint Abdullah. Fatima the daughter of Abdullah. So when she marries another man, she doesn't automatically become from his family. So she maintains her own name. Her property is her own, and the rights for owning and freely disposing of property as she wishes is something which was established when Islam came. It's not something which was modern, you know, recently given. But she had that the right to property, disposal of property. She is looked at as a separate individual and entity.
So when divorce takes place, certain property she can take that with
her? Her own property is hers. Yeah, he has no right in the property, of which is her own. You know, if she wishes to share that property with him, you know, she may do so. But what is hers, either by inheritance or he has given her, in the case of dowry, you know, in the process for marriage is also a dowry, which may be large or may be small. Whatever is given to her is hers. Yes. The man gives the dowry to the woman. And the dowry basically is symbolic of the man's preparedness to look after the woman. The woman has the right to ask for as much as she wants, you know, as little as she wants.
Now, you mentioned something about marriage among relatives. Is that things like natural relatives, cousins?
Yes, cousins, the marriage of cousins is allowed. It's not encouraged. It is allowed, not prohibited. But the Islam really encourages the marriages outside of cousins. But allowance is there for cousins. And marriage in families, within families, in general, you know, from the example of the Prophet and the early Muslim, but the Islam really encourages the marriages outside of cousins. But allowance is there for cousins. And marriage in families, within families, in general, you know, from the example of the Prophet and the early Muslims, it is one of not marrying within one's direct family, you know, it encourages. And this is one of the reasons why, for example, wherever you go in Muslim world, where Arab Muslims have gone to, you know, they intermarried with the peoples, you know, though the people may retain Arab names, you'll find people with Arab names, which are typically Arab names, in Indonesia, which with family names, strictly similar to names in South Yemen, but when you look at the people are the same as the people that are there. And the concept of intermarriage is something which has always been encouraged, you know, in Islamic tradition.
In terms of where it's not part of itself,
well, I would say, generally speaking, you know, the military has encouraged women to wear the abaya, this outer garment, etc., you know, scarf, this type of thing, to maintain a level of modesty consistent with the society as a whole, to avoid incidences, you know, problems, okay? To be very honest with you, many people here, you know, are influenced by what they have seen, not in the movies because they don't have movie theaters here, but through videos. You see, the videos of the latest movies, they come here. And to be very honest with you, the way that the woman is presented in the movie industry is one of a loose, easy to get type of individual. You know, the woman is portrayed. I mean, if you think back in terms of the movies, I mean, most of the relationships are, you know, extramarital relationships and the other. Women who now are going to dress in a... I understand with you. I agree with you perfectly. And this is a misconception, right? But at the same time that this misconception is there, we have to understand what are the roots of that misconception. And so if a person dresses in a fashion which is similar to those who are portrayed in the movies, then people are going to make that association. This is why it is preferable for the woman to cover herself in this way, to avoid these kind of incidences. I mean, of course, to be very honest with you, there are people here, no matter how much a woman is covered, they will maybe try to make some advances. Whether it is to American women or to women from other countries who are here, who are Muslims who are here, I mean, this exists. I mean, as I said, you know, this criminal element is everywhere. You know, regardless of how the law, you know, strict it is, etc., this exists. But I would say that, in general, the more covered a woman is in terms of here, American who's here in the society, who adopts herself to the local customs, the less chances of harassment would take place.
My last question has to do with religion. That religion in terms of what for this one, in terms of not a culture, especially in the church here, kind of American custom, Christian country.
Well, for a Muslim, for a Christian or a Jew to practice their religion privately, this is no, because it states very clearly in the Quran, there's no compulsion in religion. A person may practice whatever beliefs they have. But in Arabia in particular, Christians would not be allowed to set up churches here. And this is because this area is looked at as like a sanctuary for Muslims, which surrounds the most holy or most highly regarded area in Islam, Mecca and Medina, these two areas where no non-Muslims are allowed. So as part of that sanctuary, you know, this area, the Arabian Peninsula also in general, there's a non-allowance of the setting up of these institutions. If a person practices outside of this realm, you know, whatever they wish to believe in, they're allowed to do so in the privacy of their home or in other people's home. But outside, let me just complete, outside of this area, if you go into Jordan or to Sudan or Egypt, you know, Christians may set up their own churches, Jews have their own synagogues, etc. And the area of Palestine, where, as I mentioned to you, there were synagogues and cathedrals, churches, etc., which existed, you know, all during Muslim rule of that region.
Okay, but the point is that it's just like a misconception in terms of Islamic faith in Kanala, I think,
well, you see, the thing is that the concept of belief in a supreme being, a single supreme being, yes, that's what I'm saying, that's what I was coming to say. In India, also, they believe in a supreme being, in spite of all the idols and things that people generally associate to Hindus, you know, Buddhists, you know, the variety of different religions around the world, they all believe in one supreme being, you know. But what has happened is that in the course of that belief, intermediaries have been placed between themselves and that supreme being. And the supreme being himself has also been portrayed within the creation. So they end up worshipping different aspects of the creation in the belief that they're worshipping the supreme being. Okay, now, when in Islam, a Muslim says, we believe in one God, it is meant by that one God who is not portrayed in his creation, who does not have any intermediaries between himself and creation. That is the one true God. So anything other than that, though it may claim to be monotheistic from an Islamic point of view, it is looked at as being corrupted monotheism. It may have a monotheistic basis to it, but it has become corrupted. You know, the Trinity is looked at as a corruption. You know, duality in Persian, ancient Persian religion, Zoroastrians, is looked at as a corruption. You know, the Trinitarian and multiplicity of gods in India is looked at as a corruption. You know, so the monotheism that is being spoken about when a Muslim says he believes in one God, it is different from the monotheism which is generally accepted by Christianity. It is much more similar to the monotheism of Judaism. In fact, Judaism, what that of the teachings of Moses, where he talks about the one God, commandments of God to worship the one God, who is not portrayed in any images, in any way, shape, or form. The prohibition of that portrayal of God in images is to prevent man from worshipping God through creation, because any image that you try to portray of God will be something from creation, something you've seen, because you're not going to make something which doesn't, that you have not seen. So to prevent that kind of portrayal and keeping the concept of God being beyond his creation, Mosaic law was specific in prohibiting any kind of portrayal. Islamic law is consistent with that. But even in the case of Judaism, though its monotheism is very close to Islamic monotheism, and as I said, according to Islamic teachings, it is believed that the monotheism of what is known as Islam today was the same monotheism of Jesus, of Moses, of Abraham. What has happened in the case of Jewish tradition, because when Jesus came with the message of reformation, of purifying the teachings which had been handed down for generations through the Jewish line, the majority of Jews rejected him. They insisted on the deviation that they were following. You see, so there were distortions which Jesus came to correct. These distortions are referred to in the Quran. The Quran has corrected these distortions, as Muslims believe, and it has also corrected distortion which has crept into the followers of Jesus. And in Judaism, the distortion came in the concept of God being the God of Israel, our own private God. A God who is described as repenting for the evil that he thought to do to his people. You see, that kind of a concept where God is almost subservient to the people, this again is inconsistent with that pure monotheistic concept of God being the supreme, the all-powerful, the God of the universe, not the God of any particular people.
My question is, if you talk about the Western world, the changes we have got to experience in the UK, in terms of the changes that affect our people, with the rise of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia today with oil, with what's happening in Saudi Arabia today, close to years and years since we lost that in the same mode, is there a fear today of things changing in Saudi Arabia? That this ancient, traditional, beautiful way of life is going to be affected by the rest of the world, such as things may change. You mentioned about wearing these things rather than Mercedes-Benz, you know, where in the days they wore my camel. Well, we kind of chuckle a little bit at that. But there's something there. What's going to happen in the future? You know, Mercedes-Benz, the country, not closed, the country are. You can't help but be influenced by what's happening around us in the world. Is there a concern for that?
Yeah.
If there is, how is that being dealt with?
Very good question. There has been change in the society. I mean, we cannot, you know, from the, over the last 50 years here, I mean, there has been major changes which have taken place. However, these changes have been more in the area of technology than in the area of society, social changes. Okay? So the society is concerned about maintaining that social aspect, the moral values and things which were held high, you know, for generations, that these be maintained. The idea of changing to these kind of structures, driving Mercedes-Benz and going to the moon, and I mean, there is no objection to that. You know, so that's not a problem. The problem comes, you know, with, for example, students who go overseas and study and come under Western influence and come back and try to promote these ideas here. There's a struggle going on, you know. Also with the influx of the media, you know, which is promoting a certain... Because even though you may censor the media to the degree that you remove kissing and bed scenes, still there are certain philosophies and ideas that are being portrayed about morality, etc., which, you know, are looked at in this society as being harmful. So it is having an effect. I mean, you will find certain crimes here now which were inconceivable. You know, before, you know, the idea of drug rings, you know, where people are, you know, setting up and buying and distributing drugs, this is something inconceivable. You might have found some individual prior to that who went to some country where they're selling drugs, bringing it in for his own personal use. That was something, you know, which existed, and the law was there dealing with this individual. But now, a ring, you know, this people, you know, watching the media where you may have, you know, gangsters and, you know, Bugsy and, you know, these type of things where the criminals are glorified, you know, their lifestyle and this way, this you know, adventurous, you know, dashing, daring type of... this is affecting to some degree the type of crimes that you're seeing in the society now, which you didn't see 30, 40 years ago. So there is an effect taking place. You know, but at the same time, the religious element, the strong religious element in the society, you know, have, you know, called people to realization of this, to gain more control of it. You find more a concerted effort, you know, which is looked at in the West as a rise of fundamentalism, you know. This is how it's generally placed, and there's a rise of fundamentalism in Saudi Arabia. Now, but really what it is people recognizing the potential harm that is coming from this media and wealth influence, because wealth now allows people to go to places which they wouldn't have gone to before, and to go to places which have become centers of corruption, places like Thailand and other places like this, and they come back with, you know, corruption, disease, and things like this into the society, you know. AIDS is on a very low level because of the marital relations, very little extramarital sex, but still it has come into the society by people who have, you know, gone abroad and committed what they looked at as being crimes according to Islamic law. So an effect is taking place. But as I said, there is a rise, an encouragement, an education of people. You know, you have a number of centers which are formed, you know, around the country to help to educate the Saudis. You know, as to their responsibilities. Those are going abroad now. They have various courses they go to for, you know, a month, or they go for some weeks, they go through where, you know, religious individual people who have scholarship will explain to them, you know, of the values and the rationale behind the values. Because there's also a tendency that when a person is born within a system, that they take certain things for granted. So it becomes like just a cultural practice and not something done out of conviction and understanding the rationale behind it. So again, you'll find here, you know, an effort to try to bring people back to that rationalization. You'll find videos are now being produced which, you know, will present and educate people as to the Islamic values. You know, the audio tapes, just as you have tape stores which distribute Western music and Eastern music, etc., you have tape stores which distribute Islamic tapes. You know, people can listen to lectures and talks, etc., you know, trying to increase the awareness of the people, you know, in the society to the principles and the consciousness of the values and the ideas behind them, so that they will be able to handle these type of changes. But, you know, I would say that when you consider the American military presence here and its presence in other parts of the world, you will find that the effects of the military presence here in this society is minuscule in comparison to what happened elsewhere. There was fear amongst many here that similar things like what happened in Thailand, you know, these places which became R&R centers, Thailand, you know, Philippines, Manila, Hong Kong, you know, Korea. I mean, these places where, because of the American buck, the populace or a large portion of the populace became pimps and prostitutes, people selling themselves. You know, this effect didn't take place here. This is for the first time really in history where American military presence has been on a large scale, and they've left and no war babies. The war babies were amongst the American military. You know, there are no war babies from the local population. You know, which becomes a problem. I mean, look at the kids in Vietnam who are, you know, half American, half Vietnamese, who are suffering. You know, because they represent American oppression to some degree, you know, of having come to Vietnam and, you know, devastated their country. So those kids suffer because of the fact that they're half-breeds, what we can call half-breeds, you know, because they carry the features of that nation that came in and devastated our country. So they suffer. War babies suffer. War babies in Philippines, war babies in Thailand, war babies in Vietnam, they suffer. But here, there were none. Whatever war babies are, Americans. Pre-existence, in terms of a previous life, Islam does not. How can I clarify that? The existence, pre-existence, in the sense of a previous life, which is found in, say, Buddhist, Hindu tradition, where people are looked as being reincarnated, this is non-existent in Islamic teachings. However, it is believed, and this is stated in the Quran, that when Adam was created, all of Adam's descendants in the spiritual form were also created. And they were made to bear witness that God was their Lord. So that, on the day of judgment, they would not be able to claim that they were not aware of God. Nor could they claim that they were subject to the influences of their families and their tribes and their people, and they shouldn't be blamed for following a path of misguidance. This is stated in the Quran. So there is belief that man was created in a spiritual form and given a consciousness of God, which each child is born with. The society after that, you know, influences that, but the child retains, the young person, the grown person retains a consciousness of God, which is a part of his or her nature. This is basic Islamic concept. In terms of post-existence, when man dies, physical body dies, spirit goes into a state of, you could say, a state of limbo between this life and period of resurrection. Of course, it is not limbo in the sense of a long period where the person waits for resurrection, but the fact that a person, when they die, spiritually they go out of this time zone. So really, the process of resurrection almost begins at the point of death. It is believed that man will be resurrected physically and rejoined with the spirit. They will be judged. Those people in this life who believed in the one God, whatever background they came from, followers of Abraham or followers of the prophets sent to Korea or to Africa or to South America, whoever maintained those teachings, believing in the one God, you know, doing righteous deeds, such people will inherit paradise. Those who rejected that belief, who lived a life of evil, they will go to hell. Those people also who accepted the belief but did not act sufficiently on the belief, in other words, their evil deeds override their righteous deeds, those people may go to hell for a period of time, a period of purification, prior to entering paradise. Any other questions? Food is around the corner, so we only have a few more minutes. If you have any other final questions, we can take the last few and then close off. My pleasure. My pleasure.
إذا كان جاهز كذا يعني أفضل. سبحانك اللهم وبحمدك أشهد أن لا إله إلا أنت أستغفرك وأتوب إليك.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. A concise reply to Christianity. If my intention was to announce my conversion to Christianity, no Christian would complain that my speech is too blunt. So if I must reject an aspect of Christianity in a brief form, let me not also be accused of bluntness. A Muslim believes in the religion of Jesus, but sees mainline Christianity as a religion constructed about Jesus. Our protest is against two particular excesses, the apotheosis of Jesus, that is, the deification of a man, and the most frequent missionary tactics which are directed toward Muslims. To deal with the first item, and much later on, the second, Christians and Muslims who learn something of one another's religion find that a crucial issue is the nature of Jesus. The majority of Christians make Jesus divine, while Muslims say that he was no more than a prophet of God, a faultless human being. The doctrine of the Trinity avows that three distinct co-equals are God. In particular, Jesus is said to be God the Son, or the Son of God, and equal to God. As the Muslim questions details of this arrangement, the Christian usually forms a common explanation for our differences. He complains that Muslims do not really understand the Trinity, that all our complaints are actually accusing Christians of tritheism and other heresies, things that Christians don't really believe. So the Muslim seeks clarification of the teaching, and as it is explained to him, he asks at every step, how could that be so? For example, we insist that the term Son of God cannot have a literal interpretation. Sonship and divine nature would be necessary attributes of such an individual, but these are incompatible. The first, sonship, describes someone who has received life, while the second, divine nature, describes someone who received his life from no one. These are mutually exclusive requirements. To be a son is to be less than divine, and to be divine is to be no one's son. As the discussion proceeds, it is the Christian who will eventually take refuge in the response, these are things that we cannot understand. That is, his assessment of the Muslim's problem becomes something he admits to himself. He started by saying, Muslims don't understand the Trinity, and finishes by saying, nobody can. So he changes his tactics. Now he complains that Muslims refuse to accept what cannot be understood. But the modified approach is a diversion. Now the concepts of verification and understanding are confused. To illustrate, chemical reactions may be verified, but the atom is not understood. I can verify that hydrogen and oxygen combine to make water. That doesn't mean I understand the atom. This distinction between verifying and understanding is the key to our concise reply. That's the discussion. Our primary issue is more basic than resolving the difficulties of Trinitarian doctrine. Rather than ask how the Trinity can be so, we should ask why it must be so. We ask, why must Jesus be divine? A few centuries ago, European philosophers used to feel that a conjecture was proven if it could be shown that the conjecture was similar to something already stated by Aristotle. Unfortunately, that approach stopped short of challenging Aristotle and discovering truth. In the same way, if we rest the Trinitarian case on what people have said about Jesus, we stop short of establishing the truth of the matter. And our purpose here is no more than the illustration that belief in the Trinity can only be based on church authority. Many Christians admit that this is the case, but there are others who insist that the teaching was explained by Jesus himself. "Let them produce their proof," is the repeated phrase in the Quran. That is, provide the documentation that Jesus himself claimed unqualified deity. Unless this evidence can be produced, authorities are subject to challenge, and then the Christian may not evade the Muslim's questions concerning understanding. The Christian will have no justification for maintaining an illogical position, unless he is content to rely on the opinions of men. Now, for Christians, the only documents accepted as reporting the words of Jesus are the accounts given in the Bible. Now, we leave the Muslim attitude toward the Bible for later in this talk. Right now, our motivation comes from the Quranic verse which says, "Say, O people of the book, you have no ground to stand upon unless you stand fast by the law, the gospel, and all the revelation that has come to you from your Lord." In this place, Christians are advised to support their claims by citing their books. Thus, Muslims believe that no saying of Jesus can be produced which shows him grasping at equality with God. The primary issue is not whether Jesus is God. The most important question is whether he said that he was equal to God. The Bible record of sayings credited to Jesus is quite small. After allowing for duplication in the four gospel accounts, these sayings could be printed.